This is Audible.
Penguin Audio presents Silverborn by Patricia Briggs. Read for you by Lorelei King. Chapter 1. The starter complained as it turned over the old Buick's heavy engine. I felt a lot of sympathy for it, since fighting outside my weight class was something I was intimately familiar with. I'm a coyote shapeshifter playing in a world of werewolves and vampires. Outmatched is an understatement. "One more time," I told Gabriel, my 17-year-old office manager, who was sitting in the driver's seat of his mother's Buick. I sniffed and dried my nose on the shoulder of my work overalls. Runny noses are part and parcel of working in the winter. I love being a mechanic, runny nose, greasy hands and all. It's a life full of frustration and barked knuckles, followed by brief moments of triumph that make all the rest worthwhile. I find it a refuge from the chaos my life has been lately. No one is likely to die if I can't fix his car. Not even if it is his mother's car. It had been a short day at school, and Gabriel had used his free time to try to fix his mother's car. He'd taken it from running badly to not at all, then had a friend tow it to the shop to see if I could fix it. The Buick made a few more unhealthy noises. I stepped back from the open engine compartment. Fuel, fire, and air make the engine run, providing that the engine in question isn't toast. "It's not catching, Mercy," said Gabriel, as if I hadn't noticed. He gripped the steering wheel with elegant but work-roughened hands. There was a smear of grease on his cheekbone, and one eye was red because he hadn't put on safety glasses when he'd crawled under the car. He'd been rewarded with a big chunk of crud, rusty metal, and grease in his eye. Even though my big heaters were keeping the edge off the cold, we both wore jackets. There is no way to keep a shop truly warm when you are running garage doors up and down all day. "Mercy, my mama has to be at work in an hour." "The good news is that I don't think it's anything you did." I stepped away from the engine compartment and met his frantic eyes. "The bad news is that it's not going to be running in an hour. Jury's out on whether it will be back on the road at all." He slid out of the car and leaned under the hood to stare at the little engine that couldn't, as if he might find some wire I hadn't noticed that would miraculously make it run. I left him to his brooding and went through the hall to my office. Behind the counter was a grubby, used-to-be whiteboard with hooks where I put the keys of cars I was working on, and a half-dozen mystery keys that predated my tenure. I pulled a set of keys attached to a rainbow peace sign keychain, then trotted back to the garage. Gabriel was back to sitting behind the wheel of his mother's Buick and looking sick. I handed him the keys through the open window. "Take the bug," I told him. "Tell your mom that the turn signals don't blink, so she'll have to use hand signals. And tell her not to pull back on the steering wheel too hard, or it will come off." His face got stubborn. "Look," I said before he could refuse, "it's not going to cost me anything. It won't hold all the kids. Not that the Buick did. There were a lot of kids. And it doesn't have much of a heater. But it runs, and I'm not using it. We'll work on the Buick after hours until it's done, and you can owe me that many hours." I was pretty sure the engine had gone to the great junkyard in the sky, and I knew that Sylvia, Gabriel's mother, couldn't afford to buy a new engine any more than she could buy a newer car. So I call upon Z, my old mentor, to work his magic on it. Literal magic. There was not much figurative about Z. He was a fae, a gremlin whose natural element was metal.
"The bug's your project car, Mercy."
Gabriel's protest was weak. My last project car, a Carmen Ghia, had sold. My take of the profits, shared with a terrific body man and an upholsterer, had purchased a 71 Beetle and a 65 VW bus with a little left over. The bus was beautiful and didn't run. The bug had the opposite problem. "I'll work on the bus first. Take the keys." The expression on his face was older than it should have been.
Only if you'll let the girls come over and clean on Saturdays until we get the bug back to you.
I'm not dumb. His little sisters knew how to work.
I was getting the better of the bargain.
Deal, I said before he could take it back. I shoved the keys into his hand.
Go take the car to Sylvia before she's late.
I'll come back afterward.
It's late. I'm going home. Just come at the usual time tomorrow.
Tomorrow was Saturday. Officially, I was closed on the weekends, but recent excursions to fight vampires had cut into my bottom line, so I'd been staying open later and working on the weekend to make a little extra money. There was no cash in battling evil, just the opposite in my experience. Hopefully, I was done with vampires. The last incident had nearly gotten me killed, and my luck was due to run out. A woman whose best talent was changing into a coyote had no business in the big leagues. I sent Gabriel on his way and started the process of closing up. Garage doors down, heat turned to 60, lights off. Till drawer in the safe, my purse out. Just as I reached for the final light switch, my cell phone rang.
Mercy?
It was Z's son, Tad, who was going to an Ivy League college back east on full scholarship. The Fae were considered a minority, so his official status as half-Fae and his grades had gotten him in. Hard work was keeping him there.
Hey, Tad, what's up?
I got an odd message on my cell phone last night. Did Finn give you something?
Finn?
Phineas Brewster, the guy I sent you to when the police had Dad up on murder charges and you needed some information about the Fae to find out who really killed that man.
It took me a second.
The bookstore guy? He loaned me a book.
I'd been meaning to return it for a while. Just, how often do you get a chance to read a book about the mysterious Fae written by the Fae?
It was handwritten and tough to decipher, slow going, and Finn hadn't seemed anxious to get it back when he'd loaned it to me.
Tell him I'm sorry and I'll return it to him tonight. I have a date later on, but I can get it to him before that.
There was a little pause.
Actually, he was a little unclear as to whether he wanted it back or not. He just said, tell Mercy to take care of that thing I gave her. Now I can't get through to him. His phone is shut off. That's why I called you instead.
He made a frustrated noise.
Thing is, Mercy, he never turns that damn phone off. He likes to make sure his grandmother can get in touch with him.
Grandmother? Maybe Finn was younger than I'd thought.
You are worried, I said.
He made a self-deprecating noise.
I know. I'm paranoid.
No trouble, I said. I ought to get it back to him anyway. Unless he keeps long hours, he won't be at the store by the time I can get there. Do you have a home address for him?
He did. I wrote it down and let him go with reassurances. As I locked the door and set the security alarm, I glanced up at the hidden camera. Adam would probably not be watching. Unless someone triggered an alarm, mostly the cameras ran all by themselves and simply sent pictures to be recorded. Still, as I started for my car, I kissed my hand and blew it to the tiny lens that watched my every move, then mouthed, "See you tonight." My lover was worried about how well a coyote could play with the wolves, too. Being an alpha werewolf made him a little overbearing about his concern, and being the CEO of a security contracting firm for various government agencies gave him access to lots of tools to indulge his protective instincts. I'd been mad about the cameras when he'd first had them installed, but I found them reassuring now. A coyote adapts. That's how she survives. Phineas Brewster lived on the third floor of one of the new condo complexes in West Pasco. It didn't seem like the sort of place where a collector of old books would live. But maybe he got his fill of dust, mold, and mildew at work and didn't need it in his home. I was halfway between my car and the building when I realized that I hadn't brought the book when I got out of the car. I hesitated, but decided to leave it where it was, wrapped in a towel on the back seat of the Rabbit. The towel was to protect the book, in case I hadn't gotten all the grease off my hands, but it worked okay to disguise it from would-be thieves, which seemed unlikely here anyway. I climbed up two sets of stairs and knocked on the door marked 3B. After a count of 10, I rang the doorbell. Nothing. I rang the doorbell one more time, and the door at 3A opened up.
"He's not there," said a gruff voice.
I turned to see a skinny old man, neatly dressed in old boots, new jeans, a button-down western shirt, and a bolo tie. All he was missing was a cowboy hat. Something, I think it was the boots, smelled faintly of horse. And Fay. He isn't? Officially, all the Fae are out to the public and have been for a long time. But the truth is that the Grey Lords who rule the Fae have been very selective about which of them the public gets to know about and which ones might upset the public, or are more useful posing as human. There are, for instance, a few senators who are Fae in hiding. There is nothing in the Constitution that makes it illegal for a Fae to be a senator, and the Grey Lords want to keep it that way. This Fae was working pretty hard at passing for human. He wouldn't appreciate me pointing out that he wasn't, so I kept my discovery to myself. There was a twinkle in the faded eyes as he shook his head.
Nope, he hasn't been home all day.
Do you know where he is?
Finn?
The old man laughed, displaying teeth so even and white they looked false. Maybe they were.
Well now, he spends most of his time at his store. Nights, too, sometimes.
Was he here last night? I asked. He looked at me and grinned.
Nope, not him. Maybe he bought up some estate's library and is staying at the store while he catalogs it. He does that sometimes.
Finn's neighbor glanced up at the sky, judging the time.
He won't answer the door after hours. Closes himself in the basement and can't hear anyone. Best wait and go check at the shop in the morning.
I looked at my watch. I needed to get home and get ready for my date with Adam.
If you have something for him, the old man said, his eyes clear as the sky, you can leave it with me.
Fae don't lie. I used to think it was can't lie, but the book I'd borrowed made it pretty clear that there were other factors involved. Finn's neighbor hadn't said he was working at the store. He said maybe. He didn't say he didn't know where Finn was, either. My instincts were chiming pretty hard, and I had to work to appear casual. I'm here to check up on him, I told him, which was the truth. His phone is off, and I was worried about him. And then I took a chance. He hasn't mentioned any of his neighbors. Are you new?
He said, moved in not long ago, then changed the subject. Maybe he left the charger at home. Did you try the store phone?
I only have one number for him, I told him. I think that was his cell.
If you leave your name, I'll tell him you stopped in.
I let my friendly smile widen. No worries. I'll run him down myself. Good to know he has neighbors who are watching over him. I didn't thank him. Thanking a Fae implies that you feel indebted, and being indebted to a Fae is a very bad thing. I just gave him a cheerful wave from the bottom of the stairs. He didn't try to stop me. But he watched me all the way out to my car. I drove out of sight before pulling over and calling Tad.
Hello, his voice said. This is my answering machine. Maybe I'm studying, maybe I'm out having a good time. Leave your name and number, and maybe I'll call you back.
Hey, I told Tad's answering machine. This is Mercy. Finn wasn't home. I hesitated. Safely back in my car, I thought that I might have overreacted about his neighbor. The better I know the Fae, the scarier they seem. But it was probable that he was harmless. Or that he was, indeed, really scary, but it had nothing to do with Finn. So I said, Met Finn's neighbor, who is Fae. He suggested calling the store. Do you have the store's number? Have you tried calling him there? I'll keep looking for him. I hung up and put the rabbit in gear with every intention of going home. But somehow I ended up on the interstate headed for Richland instead of Finley. Finn's mysterious call to Tad and the suspicion I felt toward Finn's neighbor made me nervous. It was a short trip to Finn's bookstore, I told myself. It wouldn't hurt to just stop by. Tad was stuck on the other side of the country, and he was worried. The Uptown is a strip mall, Richland's oldest shopping center. Unlike its newer upscale counterparts, the Uptown looks as though someone took a couple dozen stores of various styles and sizes, stuck them all together, and surrounded them with a parking lot. It houses the sort of businesses that wouldn't thrive in the bigger mall in Kennewick. Non-chain restaurants, several antiques, junk stores, a couple of resale clothing boutiques, a music store, a donut shop, a bar or two, and several shops best described as
eclectic. Finn's bookstore was near the south end of the mall, its large picture windows tinted dark to protect the books from sun damage. Gilt lettering on the biggest window labeled it, Brewster's Library, Used and Collectible Books. There were no lights behind the shades in the windows, and the door was locked. I put my ear against the glass and listened. In my human shape, I still have great hearing, not quite as sharp as the coyotes, but good enough to tell that there was no one moving around in the store. I knocked, but there was no response. On the window to the right of the door was a sign with the hours the shop was open. 10 to 6, Tuesday through Saturday. Sunday and Monday, hours by appointment. The number listed was the one I already had. 6 had come and gone. I knocked on the door one last time, then glanced at my watch again. If I skirted the speed limit, I'd have 10 minutes before the wolf was at my door. My roommate's car was in the driveway, looking right at home next to the 78 single-wide trailer where I lived. Very expensive cars, like true works of art, shape the environment to suit themselves. Just by virtue of being there, his car made my home upper class, no matter what the house itself looked like. Samuel had the same gift of never being out of place, always fitting in, while at the same time he conveyed the sense that here was someone special, someone important. People liked him instinctively and trusted him. It served him well as a doctor, but I was inclined to think it served him a little too well as a man. He was too used to getting his way. When charm didn't cut it, he used a tactical brain that would have done credit to Rommel. Thus, his presence as my roommate. It had taken me a while to figure out the real reason he'd moved in with me. Samuel needed a pack. Werewolves don't do well on their own, especially not old wolves, and Samuel was a very old wolf. Old and dominant. In any pack except his father's, he would be alpha. His father was Bran, the Morak, the most uber-werewolf of them all. Samuel was a doctor, and that was more than enough responsibility for him. He didn't want to be alpha. He didn't want to stay in his father's pack. He was lone-wolfing it, living with me in the territory of the Columbia Basin pack, but not part of it. I wasn't a werewolf, but I wasn't a helpless human either. I'd been raised in his father's pack, and that was close to being family. So far, he and Adam, the local pack's alpha, and my lover, hadn't killed each other. I was moderately hopeful that would continue to be the case. "Samuel?" I called as I rushed into the house. "Samuel?" He didn't answer, but I could smell him. The distinctive odor of werewolf was too strong to be just a leftover trace. I jogged down the narrow hall to his room and knocked softly at the closed door. It was unlike him not to acknowledge me when I got home. I worried about Samuel enough to make myself paranoid. He wasn't quite right. Broken but functional, I thought, with an underlying depression that seemed to be getting neither better nor worse as the months passed. His father suspected something was wrong, and I was pretty sure the reason Samuel was living with me and not in his own house in Montana was because he didn't want his father to know for certain how badly broken Samuel really was. Samuel opened his door, looking his usual self, tall and rangy, attractive, as most werewolves are, regardless of bone structure. Perfect health, permanent youth, and lots of muscle are a pretty surefire formula for good looks.
"You rang,"
he said in an expressionless imitation of Lurch, dropping his voice further into the bass register than I'd ever heard him manage. We'd been watching a marathon of the Addams Family on TV last night. If he was being funny, he was all right, even if he wasn't quite meeting my eyes, as if he might be worried about what I'd see. A purring Medea was stretched across one shoulder. My little Manx cat gave me a pleased look out of half-slitted eyes as he stroked her. As his hand moved along her back, she dug in her hind claws and arched her tailless bud into the air.
"Ouch,"
he said, trying to pull her off, but she'd gotten her claws through his worn flannel shirt and was hooked onto him tighter than Velcro, and more painfully, too. I told him, trying not to laugh. "Adam and I are going out tonight. You're on your own for dinner. I didn't make it to the grocery store, so the pickings are meager."
His back was to me as he leaned over his bed, so if he managed to unstick the cat, she wouldn't fall all the way to the floor.
Fine, he said. Ouch, cat! Don't you know I could eat you in a single bite? You wouldn't even, ouch, even leave a tail sticking out.
I left him to it and hurried over to my own room. My cell rang before I made it to the doorway.
Mercy, he's headed over, and I've got some news for you, said Adam's teenage daughter's voice in my ear.
Hey, Jesse, where are we going tonight?
Thinking of him, I could feel his anticipation and the smooth leather of the steering wheel under his hands. Because Adam wasn't just my lover. He was my mate. In werewolf terms, that meant something slightly different for every mated pair. We were bound not just by love, but by magic. I've learned that some mated pairs can barely perceive the difference, and some virtually become the same person.
Ugh.
Thankfully, Adam and I fell somewhere in the middle.
Mostly.
We'd overloaded the magic circuit between us when we'd first sealed our bond. Since then, it had proved to be erratic and invasive, flickering in and out for a few hours, then gone again for days.
Disconcerting.
I expect I'd have gotten used to having the connection to Adam already if it were consistent, as Adam assured me it should have been. As it was, it tended to take me by surprise. I felt the wheel vibrate under Adam's hand as he started the car. Then he was gone, and I was standing in my grubbies talking to his daughter on the phone.
Bowling,
she said.
Thanks, kid, I told her. I'll bring back an ice cream cone for you. Got a shower.
You owe me $5, though ice cream wouldn't hurt,
she told me with a mercenary firmness I could respect.
You'd better shower fast.
Adam and I had a game, a just-for-fun thing. His wolf playing with me, I thought, because it had that feel. A simple game with no losers was wolf play, something they did with the ones they loved. It didn't happen often in the pack as a whole, but among smaller groups, yes. My mate wouldn't tell me where he was taking us, leaving it for me to discover his plans by whatever means necessary. It was a sign of his respect that he expected me to be successful. Tonight I bribed his daughter to call me with whatever she knew, even if it was just what he was wearing when he walked out the door. Then I'd be appropriately dressed, though I'd act astonished that we matched so well when I hadn't a clue where he was taking me. Play for flirting, but also play designed to distract both of us from the reason we were dating instead of living together as mates. His pack didn't like it that his mate was a coyote shifter. Even more than their natural brethren, wolves don't share territory well with other predators. But they'd had a long time to get used to it, and were mostly resigned, until Adam brought me into the pack. It shouldn't have been possible. I've never heard of a non-werewolf mate becoming pack. I set out clothes to wear and hopped into the shower. The showerhead was set low, so it wasn't hard to keep my braids out of the full force of the water as I scrubbed my hands with pumice soap and a nail brush. I'd already cleaned up, but every little bit helped. A lot of the dirt was ingrained, and my hands would never look fashion model tended. When I emerged from the bathroom in a towel, I could hear voices in the living room. Samuel and Adam were deliberately keeping it soft enough that I couldn't hear the words, but it didn't sound like there was any tension. They liked each other just fine, but Adam was alpha, and Samuel a lone wolf who outpowered him. Sometimes they had trouble being in the same room together, but evidently not tonight. I started to reach for the jeans I had laid out on my bed. Bowling. I hesitated. I just couldn't see it in my head. Not the bowling part. I was sure that Adam enjoyed bowling. Throwing a weighty ball at a bunch of helpless pins and watching the resultant mayhem is just the kind of thing that werewolves love. What I couldn't see was Adam telling Jesse he was taking me bowling, not when he was trying to keep it from me. The last time, all she'd been able to do was tell me what he was wearing when he left the house. Maybe I was just being paranoid. I opened my closet and looked at the meager pickings hanging there. I had more dresses than I'd had a year ago. Three more. Jesse would have noticed if he'd dressed up. I glanced at the bed where my new jeans and a dark blue t-shirt summoned me with their comfort. Bribes can go both ways, and Jesse would find it amusing to play double agent.
so I pulled out a pale gray dress, classy enough that I could wear it to all but the most formal of occasions, and not so dressy that it would look out of place at a restaurant or theater. If we really went bowling, I could bowl in the dress. I slipped into the dress and quickly unbraided my hair and brushed it out.
"Mercy, aren't you ready yet?"
asked Samuel, a touch of amusement in his voice.
"Didn't you say you had a hot date?"
I opened the door and saw I hadn't gotten it quite right. Adam was wearing a tux. Adam is shorter than Samuel, with the build of a wrestler and the face of... I don't know. It is Adam's face, and it is beautiful enough to distract people from the air of power that he conveys. His hair is dark, and he keeps it short. He told me once that it is so the military personnel that he has to deal with in the course of his security business feel comfortable with him. But these last few months, as I've gotten to know him better, I think it is because his face embarrasses him. The short hair removes any hint of vanity and says, "Here I am, let's get down to business." I would love him if he had 3 eyes and 2 teeth, but sometimes his beauty just hits me. I blinked once, took a deep breath, and brushed off the need to proclaim him mine so I could pull my mind back to interactive mode. "Ah," I said, snapping my fingers. "I knew I'd forgotten something." I ran back to my closet and snagged a sparkly silver wrap that dressed the gray up appropriately. I came back out to see Samuel giving Adam a $5 bill.
"I told you she'd figure it out," Adam said smugly.
"Good," I told him. "You can pay Jessie with that. She told me we were going bowling. I need to find a better spy." He grinned, and I had to work to keep my face annoyed. Oddly enough, given his face, it wasn't the beauty of Adam with a smile that delighted me when he grinned, though he really was spectacular. It was the knowledge that I'd made him smile. Adam was not given to playfulness, except with me.
"Hey, Mercy," Samuel said as Adam opened the front door.
I turned to him, and he gave me a kiss on the forehead.
"You be happy."
The odd phrase caught my attention, but there was nothing odd in the rest of what he said.
"I've got the red eye shift. Most likely I won't see you when you get back."
He looked up at Adam, meeting his eyes in a male-to-male challenge that had Adam's eyes narrowing.
"Take care of her."
Then he pushed us out and closed the door before Adam could take offense at the order. After a long moment, Adam laughed and shook his head.
"Don't worry,"
he said, knowing the other wolf would hear him through the door.
"Mercy takes care of herself. I just get to clean up the mess afterward."
If I hadn't been watching his face, I wouldn't have seen the twist on his lips as he spoke, as if he didn't like what he was saying very much. I felt suddenly self-conscious. I like who I am, but there are plenty of men who wouldn't. I am a mechanic. Adam's first wife had been all soft curves, and I am mostly muscle. Not very feminine, my mother liked to complain. And then there were those idiosyncrasies that were the aftermath of rape. Adam held out his hand to me, and I put mine in his. He had gotten very good at inviting my touch, at not touching me first. I looked at our clasped hands as we went down the porch stairs. I thought that I was getting better, that the involuntary flinching, the fear, was leaving. It occurred to me that maybe he was just getting better at working around my fears.
"What's wrong?"
he asked as we stopped beside his truck. It was so new there was still a sticker on the rear seat window. He'd replaced his SUV after one of his wolves had dented the fender defending me, followed by a separate incident when an ice elf, honking huge fay, who was chasing me, dropped the front half of a building on it.
"Mercy,"
he frowned at me.
"You don't owe me for the damn truck."
His hand was still holding mine, and I had a moment to realize that our fickle mate bond had given him an insight into what I was thinking, before a vision dropped me to my knees. It was dark, and Adam was at his computer in his home office. His eyes burned, his hands ached, and his back was stiff from so many hours of work. The house was quiet. Too quiet. No wife to protect from the world. It had been a long time since he'd loved her. It is dangerous to love someone who doesn't love you in return. He'd been a soldier too long to put himself deliberately in danger without a good reason,
She loved his status, his money, and his power. She'd have loved it better if it had belonged to someone who did as she told him. He didn't love her, but he loved taking care of her. Loved buying her little presents. Loved the idea of her. Losing her had been bad. Losing his daughter was much, much worse. Jessie trailed noise and cheer everywhere she went, and her absence was difficult. His wolf was restless. A creature of the moment, his wolf. There was no way to comfort it with the knowledge that he'd have Jessie back for the summer. Not that he derived much comfort from that, either. So he tried to lose himself in work. Someone knocked on the back door. He pushed back the chair and had to pause. The wolf was angry that someone had breached his sanctuary. Not even his pack had been brave enough these past few days to approach him in his home. By the time he stalked into the kitchen, he had it mostly under control. He jerked open the back door and expected to see one of his wolves. But it was Mercy. She didn't look cheerful. But then she seldom did when she had to come over and talk to him. She was tough and independent and not at all happy to have him interfere in any way with that independence. It had been a long time since someone had bossed him around the way she did. And he liked it. More than a wolf who'd been alpha for 20 years ought to like it. She smelled of burnt car oil, jasmine from the shampoo she'd been using that month, and chocolate. Or maybe that last was the cookies on the plate she handed him. "Here," she said stiffly, and he realized it was shyness that pinched in the corners of her mouth. "Chocolate usually helps me regain my balance when life kicks me in the teeth." She didn't wait for him to say anything, just turned around and walked back to her house. He took the cookies back to the office with him. After a few minutes, he ate one. Chocolate, thick and dark, spread across his tongue, its bitterness alleviated by a sinful amount of brown sugar and vanilla. He'd forgotten to eat and hadn't realized it. But it wasn't the chocolate or the food that made him feel better. It was Mercy's kindness to someone she viewed as her enemy. And right at that moment, he realized something. She would never love him for what he could do for her. He ate another cookie before getting up to make himself dinner. Adam shut down the bond between us until it was nothing more than a gossamer thread.
"I'm sorry," he murmured against my ear. "So sorry.
He swallowed the obscenity before it left his lips. He pulled me closer, and I realized we were both sitting in the gravel driveway, huddled next to the truck. And the gravel was really cold on my bare skin.
"Are you all right?" he said.
"Do you know what you showed me?" I asked. My voice was hoarse.
"I thought it was a flashback,"
he answered. He'd seen me have them before. "Not one of mine," I told him. "One of yours." He stilled.
"Was it bad?"
He'd been in Vietnam. He'd been a werewolf since before I was born. He'd probably seen a lot of bad stuff. "It seemed like a private moment that I had no business seeing," I told him truthfully, "but it wasn't bad." I'd seen him the moment that I'd become something more than an assignment from the Maroc. I remembered feeling stupid, standing on his back porch with a plate of cookies for a man whose life had just gone down in the flames of a nasty divorce. He hadn't said anything when he answered the door, so I'd assumed that he'd thought it stupid, too. I'd gone back home as fast as I could without running. I had had no idea that it had helped, nor that he saw me as tough and capable. Funny, I'd always thought I looked weak to the werewolves. So what if I still flinched if he forgot and put a hand on my shoulder? Time would fix that. I was already a lot better. Daily flashbacks to the rape were a thing of the past. We'd work through it. Adam was willing to make allowances for me. And our bond did its rubber band thing, which it did sometimes, and snapped back into place, giving him access to my thoughts as if my head were clear as glass.
"Whatever you need,"
he said, his body suddenly still as the evening air.
"Whatever I can do."
I relaxed my shoulders, burying my nose against his collarbone, and after a second, the relaxation was genuine. "I love you," I told him. And we need to talk about me paying you for that truck.
I'm not...
I cut off his words. I meant to put a finger against his lips or something tender like that. But I jerked my head up in reaction to his apology and slammed my forehead into his chin, shutting him up much more effectively than I'd meant to as he bit his tongue. He laughed as he bled down his shirt, and I babbled apologies. He let his head fall back against the truck door with a thump.
Leave off, Mercy. It'll close up quick enough on its own.
I backed up until I was sitting beside him, half laughing myself, because although it probably hurt quite a bit, he was right that his injury would heal in a few minutes. It was minor, and he was a werewolf.
You'll quit trying to pay for the SUV,
he told me. The SUV was my fault, I informed him.
You didn't throw a wall on it, he said. I might have let you pay for the dent.
Don't even try to lie to me, I huffed indignantly, and he laughed again.
Fine, I wouldn't have. But it's a moot point anyway, because after the wall fell on it, fixing the dent was out of the question. And the ice elf's lack of control was completely the vampire's fault.
I could have kept arguing with him. I usually like arguing with Adam, but there were things I liked better. I leaned forward and kissed him. He tasted of blood and Adam, and he didn't seem to have any trouble following the switch from mild bickering to passion. After a while, I don't know how long, Adam looked down at his blood-stained shirt and started laughing again.
I suppose we might as well go bowling after all,
he said, pulling me to my feet. Chapter 2 We stopped at a steakhouse for dinner first. He'd left the blood-stained coat and formal shirt in the car and snagged a dark blue T-shirt from a bag of miscellaneous clothes in the back seat. He asked me if he looked odd wearing a T-shirt with tuxedo pants. He couldn't see the way the shirt clung to the muscles of his shoulders and back. I reassured him, truthfully and with a straight face, that no one would care. It was Friday night, and business was brisk. Happily, the service was fast. After the waitress took our orders, Adam said a little too casually,
"So what did you see in your vision?"
"Nothing embarrassing," I told him. "Just one time when I brought cookies over to you." His eyes brightened.
"I see,"
he said, and his shoulders relaxed a bit, even if his cheeks reddened.
"I was thinking about that."
"We okay?" I asked him. "I'm sorry I intruded." He shook his head.
"No apologies necessary. You're welcome to whatever you pick up."
"So," I said casually, "your first time was under the bleachers, huh?" He jerked his head up. "Gotcha. Warren told me." He smiled.
"Cold and wet and miserable."
The waitress plunked our food down in front of us and hurried on her way. Adam fed me bites of his rare filet mignon, and I fed him some of my salmon. Food was good, company better, and if I had been a cat, I'd have purred.
"You look happy."
He took a sip of his coffee and stretched out a leg so his foot was against mine. "You make me happy," I told him.
"You could be happy all the time,"
he said, eating the last bite of baked potato.
"And move in with me."
"To wake up next to him every morning, but..." "Nope, I've caused you enough trouble," I told him. "The pack and I need to come to detente before I'm moving in. Your home is the den, the heart of the pack. They need a place where they feel safe."
"They can adjust."
"They're adjusting as fast as they can," I told him. "First there was Warren. Did you hear that after you let him in, several other packs have allowed gay wolves to join, too? And now there's me. A coyote in a werewolf pack. You have to admit that's quite a lot of change for one pack to take."
"Next thing you know," he said, "women will have the vote or a black man will become president."
He looked serious, but there was humor in his voice. "See?" I pointed my fork at him. "They're all stuck in the 1800s, and you're expecting them to change. Samuel likes to say that most werewolves have all the change they can deal with the first time they become wolf. Other kinds of change are tough to force on them."
"Peter and Warren are the only ones who've been around since the 1800s, Adam told me. "Most of them are younger than I am."
The waitress came and blinked a little as Adam ordered three desserts. Werewolves take a lot of food to keep themselves fueled up.
I shook my head when she looked my way. When she left, I took up the conversation from where I'd left off. It won't hurt us to wait a few months until things settle down. If he hadn't basically agreed with me, I'd have been sleeping in his house already instead of making do with dates. He understood as well as I did that pulling me into his pack had caused a lot of resentment. Maybe if it had been a healthy, well-adjusted pack beforehand, things wouldn't have gotten so tense. A few years ago, some of his pack had started harassing me, a coyote living next door. Werewolves, like their natural brethren, are territorial, and they don't share their hunting ground easily with other predators. So, to put a stop to it, Adam declared me his mate. I hadn't known at the time why the harassment abruptly stopped, and Adam hadn't been in a hurry to tell me. But pack magic demanded that the declaration be answered, and Adam bore the cost when it wasn't. It left him weaker, crabbier, and less able to help his pack stay calm, cool, and collected. By bringing me in as a member of his pack at virtually the same time our mating bond connected, Adam hadn't given his people a chance to get their feet underneath them before throwing them back onto uncertain ground.
"One more month," he said finally, "and then they, and Samuel too, will just have to get used to it."
His eyes, the color of bitter dark chocolate, were serious as he leaned forward.
"And you will marry me."
I smiled, showing my teeth. "Don't you mean, will you marry me?" I meant it to be funny, but his eyes brightened until little gold flecks were swimming in the darkness.
"You had your chance to run, Coyote. It's too late now."
He smiled.
"Your mother is happy that she'll be able to use some of the stuff from your sister's wedding that wasn't."
Panic swelled my heart. "You didn't talk to her about this, did you?" I had visions of a church filled with people and white satin everywhere. And doves. My mother had had doves at her wedding. My sister had eloped to get away from her. My mother is a steamroller, and she doesn't listen very well. To anyone. The wolf left his eyes, and he grinned.
"You're okay with marrying a werewolf who is a teenage daughter and a pack that's falling apart, and your mother panics you?"
"You've met my mother," I said. "She ought to panic you, too." He laughed. "You just weren't around her long enough." It was only fair that I warn him. We were lucky and got our scoring table to ourselves, as the women who had the lane to our left were packing up when we got back from choosing our bowling balls from the available stack. Mine was bright green with gold swirls. Adam's was black. "You have no imagination," I told him smugly. "It wouldn't hurt if you found a pink ball to bowl with."
"All the pink balls have kid-sized holes in them," he told me. "The black balls are the heaviest."
I opened my mouth, but he shut me up with a kiss.
"Not here," he said. "Look next to us."
We were being observed by a boy of about 5 and a toddler in a frilly pink dress. I raised my nose in the air. "As if I were going to joke about your ball. How juvenile." He grinned at me.
"I thought you'd feel that way."
I sat down and messed with the player names on the interface on the scoring table until I was satisfied.
"Found on road dead," he said dryly, looking over my shoulder.
I thought I'd use our car as his names. "You drive a Ford now. F-O-R-D.
"Very woo-hoo?"
"Not a lot of cool words start with a W," I admitted. He leaned over my shoulder and changed it to vintage wabbit. Then into my ear he said,
"Very wicked. Mine."
I can live with that. His warm breath on my ear felt very wicked, all right. Until Adam, I'd always felt like his black bowling ball. Boring, but useful. I'm nothing special in the looks department, once you get past the slightly exotic coloring my Blackfoot father gave me. And Adam, heads turn when Adam walks by. Even in the bowling alley, he was attracting attention. "Go throw your boring black ball," I told him sternly. "Flirting with the scorekeeper won't help you because the computers keep score now."
"As if I needed help,"
he smirked, walking backward a few steps before he turned around to pay attention to the poor, helpless bowling pins. He bowled with the deadly earnestness and decisive style with which he did everything else. Controlled power. That was Adam. But I started noticing something other than admiration in the gazes of the people who were beginning to look at us, at Adam. He wasn't really a celebrity. He tried to stay out of the news, but Adam was one of the wolves who was out to the public. A sober, successful businessman whose security company protected American nuclear technology from foreign hands. A good guy who happened to be a werewolf. All fine and dandy when they read about it in the newspapers, I guess. But it was different to see a werewolf at their bowling alley. They are afraid of him. The thought was so strong, it felt as if someone were whispering into my ear, bringing with it worry. I saw the men bristling over their women, the mothers hastily gathering their children to them. In a moment, there would be a mass exodus. And that was assuming that some of the young men I saw coming to their feet about four lanes down didn't do something stupid. He hasn't noticed yet. Adam gave me a sly, pleased grin at his strike as he walked back. A strike more remarkable because there were no shattered pins, no broken equipment. Too much power can be as great a disadvantage as not enough. Look beside you. I took up my green ball and glanced at the people next to us. Like Adam, they were too involved in their game to notice the growing murmuring. The young boy was crawling under the chairs, and his parents were bickering over something on the scorecard. Their too cute toddler, with her pink dress and little pink lions in the 2-inch ponytails that stuck out from the back of her head, had climbed up on the bowling platform and was playing with the ball return blowers designed to dry sweaty palms. She wiggled her little hands over the cool air and laughed. Adam will feel bad when he notices that people are leaving because he's here. Sweat gathered on my forehead, which was ridiculous because it was cool inside. I paused halfway to the throw line, or whatever it was called, and, imitating Adam, I brought the ball up and held it in the middle of my chest. Perhaps there's a way to show everyone that he's not a monster. He's a hero. I glanced over my shoulder and watched the toddler bang on the air vent. Her brother had wandered back through the seating area and was playing with the balls on the racks. His mother had just noticed he'd gotten away from her and had gotten up to go get him. I turned my attention back to the pins. "Are you watching?" I asked Adam. The urge to do something for Adam was so strong it made my hands clench.
"My eyes are peeled," he said. "Are you going to do something amazing?"
I swung the ball awkwardly, as if I'd never bowled before, missed the release, and sent it zipping backward toward the little girl playing with the air. As soon as it left my fingers, I couldn't believe what I'd done. Sweating, shaking, and horrified, I turned. But as quick as I was, I'd missed the action. Adam had caught the ball a good 2 feet short of the toddler. She looked up at Adam, whose noisy fall to the ground had disturbed her play. When she saw that there was a strange man so close, her eyes got big and her bottom lip stuck out. Adam is mostly uninterested in children, other than his own, until they are teenagers or older, and, as he told me once, capable of interesting conversation.
"Hey,"
he said, looking very uncomfortable. She considered him a moment. But she was female, and Adam was, well, Adam. So she put her hands in front of her mouth and giggled. It was adorable, darling cute. He was a goner. And everyone who was watching could see it. The miniature conqueror squealed as her father grabbed her up, and her mother, little boy in tow behind her, babbled out thanks.
"And you are the villain of the piece, poor Mercy."
Of course I was the bad guy. I'd nearly smooshed a toddler. What had I been thinking? If she'd taken a step back, or if Adam hadn't been fast enough, she could have been killed.
She wasn't in any danger. You didn't throw it at her, just rolled it past her. It wouldn't have hit her. You saved him, and he didn't even notice.
He frowned at me after we moved over a lane, for the safety of everyone, though the anxious manager didn't actually come out and say that. We restarted the game, and he let me bowl first. I carefully rolled the first ball down the gutter, where it wouldn't be likely to hit anyone. I don't know if I did it for my own sake, or to reassure anyone watching me.
All you were trying to do was keep Adam happy, and this is the thanks you get.
Almost squishing babies wasn't exactly an act I expected thanks for. I rubbed my forehead as if it would help clear my thoughts.
It wouldn't have hit her. You made sure of it. Even if Adam had missed, it would have rolled harmlessly past.
Adam watched me thoughtfully, but he didn't say anything to me as I engineered my loss by 100 bazillion points. I could hardly bowl well after my spectacular failure, or someone would figure out I'd done it on purpose. I had done it on purpose, hadn't I? I couldn't believe I'd done something like that. What was wrong with me? If Adam had looked more approachable, I might have talked to him about it.
He doesn't want to hear what you have to say. Best just keep quiet. He'd never understand, anyway.
I didn't mind, didn't object anyhow, to the way Adam made sure to stand where he could field my ball if I lost control again. After all, his rescue of the baby looked better if he seemed to think I was an idiot, right? 4 turns in, Adam stepped in front of me and said in a low voice that wouldn't carry beyond us,
"You did it on purpose, didn't you? What in the hell were you thinking?"
And for some reason, even though I agreed with him, his question made me mad. Or maybe that was the voice in my head.
He should have understood sooner. He should have understood his mate better than anyone. You shouldn't have to defend yourself to him. Best not to say anything at all.
I raised an eyebrow and stalked past him to pick up my ball. Hurt fed anger. I was so mad I forgot myself enough to get a strike. I made sure it was the last point I made in the game, and I didn't say a word to him. Adam won with a score over 200. When he finished bowling the last frame, he took both our balls back to the rack while I changed my shoes. The teenage boys, by then 5 lanes away, stopped him and had him sign an autograph for them. I took my shoes back to the desk and turned them in, and paid for the game, too.
"Is he really the alpha?" asked the teenage girl behind the counter.
"Yep," I said through clenched lips.
"Wow."
"Yep." I left the bowling alley and waited for him by the side of his shiny new truck, which was locked. The temperature had dropped by 20 degrees as soon as the sun went down, and it was cold enough to make me in my heels and dress uncomfortable. Or it would have been if my temper hadn't kept me nice and warm. I stood by the passenger door, and he didn't see me at first. I saw him lift his head and sniff the air. I leaned my hip against the side of the truck, and the movement caught his attention. He kept his eyes on me as he walked from the building to the truck.
"He thought you'd deliberately endanger a child to make him look good. He doesn't understand that you'd never do such a thing. She wouldn't have gotten hurt. The ball would have rolled past her harmlessly. He owes you an apology."
I didn't say anything to him. I could hardly tell him that the little voices made me do it, could I? His eyes narrowed, but he kept his mouth shut, too. He popped the locks and let me get myself into the truck. I paid attention to the buckle, then settled back in the seat and closed my eyes. My hands clenched in my lap, then loosened as a familiar shape inserted itself and my hands closed on the old wood and silver of the Fey-made walking stick. I'd gotten so used to it showing up unexpectedly, I wasn't even surprised, though this was the first time I'd actually felt it appear where it hadn't been. I was more preoccupied with the disaster of our date. With a walking stick in my hands, it felt as if my head cleared at last. Abruptly, I wasn't angry anymore. I was just tired, and I wanted to go home.
"Mercy."
Adam was angry enough for the both of us. I could hear the grinding of his teeth. He thought I would throw a bowling ball at a little girl. I couldn't blame him for his anger. I moved the walking stick until the base was on the floor, then rubbed my thumb on the silver head. There was nothing I could say to defend myself. I didn't want to defend myself. I'd been recklessly stupid. What if Adam had been slower? I felt sick.
"I don't understand women,"
he bit out, starting the car up and gunning the gas a little harder than necessary. I gripped the ferry stick with all my might and kept my eyes closed all the way home. My stomach hurt. He was right to be angry, right to be upset. I had the desperate feeling something was wrong, wrong, wrong. I couldn't talk to him because I was afraid I'd make everything worse. I needed to understand why I'd done what I'd done before I could make him understand.
We pulled into my driveway in silence. Samuel's car was gone, so he must have headed into work earlier than he meant to. I needed to talk to him, because I had a very nasty suspicion about tonight. I couldn't talk to Adam, because it would sound like I was trying to find excuses for myself. I needed Samuel, and he wasn't here. I released my seatbelt and unlocked my door. Adam's arm shot in front of me and held the door closed.
"We need to talk,"
he said, and this time he didn't sound angry. But he was too close. I couldn't breathe with him this close, and right then, when I could least afford it, I had another panic attack. With a desperate sound I couldn't help, I jerked my feet to the seat and propelled myself up and over the front seat and into the back. The back door was locked, too, but even as I started to struggle with the latch, Adam popped the lock, and I was free. I stumbled back away from the truck, shaking and sweating in the night air, the Fae stick in one hand like a cudgel or a sword that could protect me from being stupid, stupid, stupid. Damn Tim and all that he'd done for leaving me stupidly shaking while I stood perfectly safely in the middle of my own stupid driveway. I wanted to be myself again, instead of this stranger who was afraid of being touched, who had little voices in her head that made her throw bowling balls at children.
"Mercy," Adam said.
He'd gotten out of the truck and come around the back of it. His voice was gentle, and the sound of it, abruptly, I could feel his sorrow and bewilderment. Something had happened, and he didn't know what it was. He just knew he'd screwed up somehow. He had no idea how it had gone so badly wrong. I didn't want to know what he was feeling, because it only made me stupider and more vulnerable. "I have to go in," I told the stick in my hand, because I couldn't look up at Adam's face just then. If I'd looked at him, I think I would have run, and he'd have chased me. Some other day that might have been fun. Tonight, it would be disastrous. So I moved, slowly. He didn't follow me as I walked to my door, but said from where he stood,
"I'll send someone over to stand guard."
Because I was the Alpha's mate. Because he worried about me. Because of Tim. Because of guilt.
"No,"
he said, taking a step closer to me, telling me the bond was stronger on his side at that moment.
"Because I love you."
I shut the door gently between us and leaned my forehead against it. My stomach hurt. My throat was tight. I wanted to scream or punch someone, but instead I clenched the walking stick until my fingers hurt and listened to Adam get in his truck and back out of my driveway. I looked down at the walking stick. Once, maybe still, it made all the sheep its bearer owned have twins. But it had been fashioned a long time ago, and old magic sometimes grew and developed in strange ways. It had become more than just a walking stick with agricultural applications. Exactly what that meant, no one really knew, other than it followed me around. Maybe it was a coincidence that the first time I'd felt like myself since walking into the bowling alley was when I'd grabbed it in Adam's truck. And maybe it wasn't. I've had a lot of fights with Adam over the years. Probably inevitable given who we were, the literal as well as figurative alpha male, and me, who was raised among lots of dominant-type males and had chosen not to let them control me, no matter how benign that control might have been. I'd never felt like this after a fight, though. Usually I feel energized and cheerful, not sick and scared out of my skin. Of course, usually the fight is my idea, and not someone using the pack bonds to play with my head. I could be wrong, I thought. Maybe it had been some new kind of nifty reaction to my run-in with the not-so-dearly-departed Tim, as if panic attacks and flashbacks weren't enough. But now that it was over, the voices tasted like the pack to me. I'd never heard of pack being able to influence someone through the bonds, but there was a lot I didn't understand about pack magic. I needed to shed my skin, free myself for a little while of the pack and mate bonds that left too many people with access to my head. I could do that. Maybe I couldn't get rid of everything, but I could shed my human skin and run alone, clear my head for just a little bit. I needed to figure out for certain what had happened tonight. Distance didn't always provide me